I was in a coma for 6 weeks while the doctors told my wife I was going to die. When I woke up, she told me the most fantastic story. My team kept running the business without me. Freelancers reached out to my team and said, "We will do whatever it takes as long as Craig's in the hospital." I consider that the greatest accomplishment in my career. My name is Craig Andrews, and this is the Leaders and Legacies podcast, where we talk to leaders creating an impact beyond themselves. At the end of today's interview, I'll tell you how you can be the next leader featured on this show. Today, I want to welcome Hillary Gale. She is the founder and CEO of Moneta Copy. She is a marketing strategist and copywriter for the financial service professionals. Translation, that means she knows how to write compliant copy and keep her clients out of jail. She has Bylines and MarketWatch, Wealth Tender, and Clever Girl Finance. Hillary is also the host of the Finance Marketing Podcast. It's a show that spotlights in-depth conversations on marketing with financial professionals and finance marketing experts. Hillary, welcome.
Thank you, Craig. I'm so happy to be here with you.
I've been looking forward to it. You know, we connected, what, 5-6 weeks ago, and then my life went chaotic and we rescheduled. But, you know, I'm looking forward to this. You know, we haven't had a lot of people talk about copy. And, you know, for those that are listening, that may seem boring. But you know what? Words are some of the most powerful things. And I would say, and I'm interested in your take, but I would say that if you want to be able to move people, you'd better be able to master words.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. I think in the world of marketing, people get so excited about design and does their website look pretty and do they have the right brand colors and things like that. And yes, that's important. But really, it's the words that are going to connect with people. It's not the colors that are on your website. It's the words that are going to make people take an action.
Yeah. Now, I'm weird in the marketing world. I'm an engineer by training. Mm. And when I studied writing, both in high school and college, high school taught me how to be a bad writer. College taught me how to be a worse writer. And everything we wrote was like boring. I mean, it was almost like we were taught to write to bore our audience to tears.
Yeah.
And I realize I'm talking to somebody who used to be a teacher.
Yes. So I am a former college writing teacher. I want to believe that I was a better teacher than the teachers that you had, Craig. And without tooting my own horn too much, I think that I was, because of the way that I taught writing and the way that I wanted people to learn how to write, because I saw what the value of it was. But I will agree with you 100%. The way that I was taught to write in high school was horrific. I grew up in Arizona, and at the time, the Arizona education system offered full ride scholarships to in-state universities for students who exceeds expectations on all three sections of the standardized test, whatever it might be. The reading section knocked it out of the park. The math section, I knocked it out of the park. I had to retake the writing section 3 times, even though I was a fabulous writer, as you can ask my college teachers. And what finally helped me exceed expectations was, instead of trying to write a good essay, I just wrote the standard 5-paragraph essay that I had been taught that was just, it was the most boring thing I've ever written in my life. And it was so formulaic. But once I finally realized, oh, that's what they're looking for, exceeds expectations, full ride tuition to whatever state university I wanted to go to.
Wow. So you had to be a little bit of a chameleon. You had to trash your own writing just to get into the education system.
Exactly. And so when I became a college writing teacher, and maybe things were changing in the education system at that time, I don't know, but our biggest focus was teaching our students how to write for different audiences. And so they would have various projects throughout the semester that would teach them how to adapt their writing for different audiences. So it wasn't just the boring research papers or the boring argument papers. It was, okay, who is the audience for this paper? And how are you going to appeal to that audience? And how are you going to write something? And then we're going to take that same topic in our next paper, but we have a new audience. So how are we going to adapt the arguments and the writing and things like that to appeal to this new audience? So that I think was a better way of teaching writing. And I also think it prepared me to enter the world of marketing when I decided to make a career shift.
Wow. So a real argument that happened in my business about 10 years ago was, you know, we call them info papers. You know, some people call, well, actually, this is when originally at the time I was calling them white papers, and we were publishing a white paper for the client. And I think I wrote the first draft and I hand it to my copywriter and she sends it back. And she said, I'm not kidding. She's like, Craig, this is too interesting. It's too engaging. This is a white paper. So we need to dumb it down or we need to make it boring. And she, because she believed white papers had to be boring, she intentionally made it boring.
Yeah.
And that's why I quit using the term white papers, because it carried all that baggage. I was like, I can only think of one type of writing where you intentionally bore your reader. And mm-hmm. that is if you're a CFO and you have a financial disclosure to make, you bore them to tears and put your financial disclosure in the middle, hoping they never get to it.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I've written several lead magnets over my career, and several of them are PDFs. I would say one was a white paper, and all of the others I would call ebooks or workbooks or something that is not as horrifyingly boring as a white paper, because white papers are boring and they're scientific and they're academic and nobody reads them.
Yeah. My first publication, I keep actually, you know, I have it, trying to think if we've packed it yet, we're moving, but I keep, just as a reminder, it's part of my wall of shame. It was published in a scholarly journal, and I packed as many obtuse words into that and tried to make it sound highbrow. And it was just horrible. It was horrible, but that's what school taught me. So you're in college, or you're teaching at college, and you obviously were not teaching the same things my professors were teaching.
Right. I actually had a student one semester, the first paper that he turned in, it should probably be on his wall of shame. It was one of those that was just packed to the brim with, there were words that I had to look up. I had never, ever heard these words. There were tons of them in this essay. And you could tell he expected me to be really impressed by what he had written. And I unfortunately had to rip the paper apart, not literally, but, you know, figuratively with feedback, and just kind of reframe this for him. No, we're not writing to impress people. We're writing to change people's minds, and we're writing to connect with people and to develop relationships and empathy with people. That's what we're trying to achieve here. And so I hope that I did a good job of that.
You know, there's a guy named Chris Maddock that taught me a lot about writing. He actually studied under James Michener. But he's a marketer. And he was talking once about Don Quixote and about how he's reading this work hundreds of years old, and Cervantes, who wrote it hundreds of years ago, can bring him to tears today. And that's the power of the writer, is you can pass across generations and you can move people emotionally. You can persuade them. You can sell them.
Absolutely. I think there's just, there's so much power with the words that you write. And I just think, especially in the age of AI and ChatGPT, people are forgetting how powerful those words can be. But the people who know how powerful they can be and who have retained that craft and who really hone that craft, it's going to be easier for them to stand out amidst all of the drivel that's out there.
You know, I'm hearing this a little bit less, thankfully, but so many people, you know, that knew they needed to be blogging and they just didn't like blogging. And ChatGPT comes out and they're like, hey, I found my blog writer. And they act as if they're the only company in the world that figured out that secret. They're like, I'm going to have AI write all my blogs. And I'm like, what do you think your competition's doing?
Right.
Mass generated AI content's the new noise level. So if you want to be in the noise, have at it.
Yes. I could not agree more. And honestly, I think it is such a service to the people who are willing to put in the work and willing to build their personal brands and they want to connect with people. It's going to be easier now. You're going to stand out even more.
Yeah. So, all right, I'm lost. You're teaching in college. Now you're not teaching in college. Well, how did you go from there to here?
Okay, so it all happened in 2020. Let's go back to, we all know what happened in 2020. I was already kind of looking for a way out of teaching. In my particular field, teaching college, the job security was not there and the pay was really, really low. So I loved working with college students. I loved what I was teaching. I was very passionate about it, but it was not affording me the lifestyle that I really had set out for myself. And so I was already trying to think of ways, well, what skills do I have? That's a movie quote from one of my favorite movies from the 80s.
What movie?
She's Having a Baby.
Oh, okay. Interesting. All right, let's see where this goes.
So anyways, I was already thinking of a way out. I was already interested in finance and personal finance. So I knew that I really wanted to work in the finance realm. I really wanted to work with financial advisors. And so I started freelancing and just seeing if financial advisors needed help with their blogs. At that point, we didn't have ChatGPT, AI, things like that. So people were hiring writers to write blogs for them. And so that's kind of where I dipped my toes in. I started a little side hustle. And pretty soon as I was writing blogs, I was realizing there's so many other types of communication that business owners and advisors need to write. They need website copy. They need emails. They need lead magnets, things like that. And those things required a lot more strategy than just the blogs. And so I just dove headfirst into marketing. You know, my background up to that point had been mostly in English. I really fell in love with all of the strategy. I already had this great background of teaching people how to write for audiences. And that's really what marketing is it's figuring out who your audience is and then connecting with them so that they want to buy from you. And I lost my train of thought. Oh no, I got it back. So as I started doing this and building up this little side hustle, pretty soon I was earning more and more money. I got to a point where I was actually almost tripling my teaching salary just for my side hustle. And so there came a point when it didn't make sense anymore to be giving my time to teaching. So I up and quit in the middle of the semester, which you should not do as a teacher, but I up and quit in October so that I could go all in on this little business that I was building. And 3 days later, I found out I was pregnant. And so it became this.
She's having a baby.
She's having a baby. It's full circle. But it became this moment for me of, okay, I just went all in on this business working for myself. I'm the only one in the business at this point. Now I have 9 months to figure out how to make this business profitable enough that I can take some time away from it. I did not want to be that person who was working from the hospital bed. And the day I bring the baby home, I'm, you know, writing content for clients or answering emails. I really wanted to be able to take some time off, enjoy my maternity leave. This is, you know, my first child. And so that's what I did. I just kind of put on my big girl pants and figured it out.
That's amazing. You know, as you tell that, for me, I'm kind of terrified on your behalf. Was that scary?
Oh, it was very scary because 3 months prior to this happening, to this moment where I found out I'm pregnant, I was making enough money that I had just given my husband permission to quit his 9-to-5 job and start his business. And so he was this brand new entrepreneur. We're both entrepreneurs trying to figure things out. And now we have a baby on the way. So it was very terrifying. It was, I would say that that whole pregnancy, I look back on that time, that those 9 months, it was pretty anxiety filled.
I bet. Oh my goodness.
Wow. But he's 3 now and we're doing great. We have another child now. We have 2 now. So it all worked out.
Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? It always works out. But, and I think, I mean, I would imagine that gave you a lot more focus, gave you a lot, helped you clear out some of the noise in the head and figure out what was really important.
I always say there is nothing like an impending due date as a deadline. I mean, there is no more important deadline than a baby coming because you can't move that deadline. And they can move the deadline. They can decide when the deadline is, but you really have no control over the deadline.
And it's not like, so me, I'm selling my house. I told you our sprinkler system is broken. Yeah. We can list the house without that being broken. I just have to, or with it being broken, I just have to fix it before we sell the house. But it's not like a human being is depending on me for every bit of life and nourishment and care.
Right. Exactly. And it was very important for me. I don't know if this is TMI, but I wanted to breastfeed my babies. And so it really felt like all of this pressure on me to, and I was making much more money than my husband was at the time. It felt like I'm the only person that can do all of the things. How am I going to do this? And what can I delegate? And who can I bring in to help me? So again, I mean, I don't know how deep into the weeds we want to get with this here, but that was kind of my foray into this career path.
That's cool. So let's explore this for a second. You know, so obviously I believe, and you believe, that businesses need professional copywriters who know how to persuade people, how to move people. But I think everybody should aspire to be a better writer, even if you have somebody else doing your copy for you. Let's do some nuts and bolts. What are some common mistakes that you see business owners making in their writing, and how do we fix them?
I think the number one mistake that I see, and this is from a person who's coming from academia, is I think that businesses, they try to be too academic in their writing. I think they try to be too polished and professional, and they want everything to be perfectly grammatically correct, whatever that means. And I think that we need to let our hair down a little bit, for lack of a better phrase, and talk to people the way that they talk to their friends, talk to people the way that they want to be communicated with, because that's what they're going to resonate with and connect to emotionally. They're not going to connect with a communication that is emotionless.
Yeah. You know, I told you about the argument we had about 10 years ago. We had another argument. I had written some copy. It was email copy. And I hand it off to editor, and she looks at it and she says, "Craig, you have a grammar error here." And I think it was subject, verb, agreement. I forget. There was some type of grammar error. And I was like, "Yeah, but I like it."
Yeah.
And so I had another editor. I said, let's hand it over to this other person. She looked at it and she came back and she said, "Craig, no, it's, you know, we need to fix that. It doesn't look professional." And I was like, okay, 2 against 1. I must be wrong here. All right. And I told her, I said, "Go fix it." A day later, she came back and she said, "Craig, I'm so upset. You were right. As soon as I made it grammatically correct, it read dry, boring, and stale." And we spent hours debating this, and finally decided to intentionally put grammar errors in our copy because it humanized it.
Yeah. it humanized it. It's less formal. It's how people talk. And that when people are interacting with businesses and business communication, again, I feel like I'm repeating myself, but it's so important. That is what they connect with. And that is what they resonate with. When I was first starting in the business, I was writing for another agency. And I was writing a website for a financial advisor who had hired the agency. And the financial advisor's wife was a high school English teacher. And so when I returned the website copy back, her feedback, she started it off with, "I'm a high school English teacher, so I'm really picky." She completely stripped it of all emotion, right? She just totally just dried it out. And it was so hard for me to not come back and say, "Well, I'm a college English teacher. And trust me, the version that I wrote is going to do so much better for your husband's business than this version that you've created." And I just think that that's because, I could get so in the weeds here. I have a linguistics background. That's what I did my master's in, was linguistics and teaching English as a second language. And so I learned a lot about grammar and how academic grammar is one system, but then we have other grammatical rules for other types of writing and genres and things like that. And they're all unspoken, and there's not really books written about, you know, grammar for different types of writing. But it you can't just apply the grammar that we learn about academic writing to all these different forms of writing, because it's not going to be as effective, is what it comes down to.
Well, Ernest Hemingway got the Nobel Prize for publishing The Old Man and the Sea.
Mm-hmm.
First thing is, that's written at a fifth grade level.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is, the last sentence of the opening paragraph is a run-on sentence, and he got the Nobel Prize. One of the best writers in American history.
I think he knew something.
Yeah. All right. So again, let's tackle, before we wrap up, let's tackle a couple more nuts and bolts, what business owners could do to be better writers.
What business owners can do to be better writers. I think that the most important thing that you can do to be a better writer is just to write all the time. You cannot outsource all of your writing to ChatGPT. And if you are doing that, don't just copy paste it. Take back what it gives you and work with it and wrestle with it and rewrite it, so that you are developing that writing muscle. You know how you're getting to know your own writing voice, so that that can come through and stand out from everyone else's writing voices. I think it's just so important to spend not hours a day writing, but be intentional about the times you find yourself writing anyways, and reflect on it. So when you're writing emails to clients, reflect on the choices that you're making in your writing, so that you can get to know your own voice. And I just write as much as you can if you want to become a better writer.
Huh. Turns out it's like everything else in life. If you want to get better at it, do more of it.
I think the biggest myth about writing is that there are people who are born natural writers and there are people who are just never going to be good writers. That is just not the case at all. Writing is a skill, just like basketball or playing the piano. You just have to put in the practice and the hours, and you will become a good writer.
Well, and I think anybody that's going to be successful in business needs to be a better communicator.
Mm-hmm.
And writing is part of that. But they still need help from folks like you. How can people get in touch with you?
I am on LinkedIn almost every single day. LinkedIn is great. My name on LinkedIn is Hillary Gale Meehan. I've tacked on my married name there. So Hillary Gale Meehan on LinkedIn. And then my website is monettacopy.com. And then, of course, the podcast, Finance Marketing Podcast, which is on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, on my website. We're not on YouTube yet, but we are going to be on YouTube soon. Those would be the top three.
Well, Hillary, this has been really powerful, and I love the takeaway. Thanks for giving the nuts and bolts, because I really think it is important for business owners to do more writing. But at the same time, I hope folks reach out to you so you can help them be really persuasive. Thanks for coming on Leaders and Legacies.
Thanks so much for having me, Craig. It was fun.
This is Craig Andrews. I want to thank you for listening to the Leaders and Legacies podcast. We're looking for leaders to share how they're making impact beyond themselves. If that's you, please go to alliesforme.com/guest and sign up there. If you got something out of this interview, we would love you to share this episode on social media. Just do a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend or post it on the socials. If you know someone who would be a great guest, tag them on social media and let them know about the show, including the hashtag Leaders and Legacies. I love seeing your posts and suggestions. We are regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you don't miss anything, please go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show. It means a lot to me. It means a lot to my team. If you want to know more, please go to alliesforme.com or follow me on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.